Oh wait, I don't hear you.
Okay, we're good. Okay. Good morning, and thank you so much for joining us for SPIRIT, the stimulating program initiative for retirees that inspires thought. I'm Judy Steinig, Director of Community Programs for the Orthodox Union, and it is my honor to coordinate and host this program. The OU created SPIRIT several years ago as an on-site program, and we are now happy to present it in a virtual setting. The OU recognizes that as the baby boomers leave their professional responsibilities, everyone is looking for educational stimulation. The goal of SPIRIT is to bring together retirees, not yet retirees, empty nesters, sandwich generation, parents, baby boomers, and seniors, and give them opportunities for spiritual and intellectual growth. Now we see, of course, with the coronavirus that we're all stuck inside, and we've discovered that SPIRIT is the perfect way to engage everyone in a virtual setting. Today's topic is a very sobering one, but an important one for all of us to know. And it's called Understanding Dementia, Warning Signs and Caregiving Strategies. We're happy to welcome Adina Siegel, LCSW, who is a Jewish community outreach social worker with Caring Kind, which is New York City's leading expert in Alzheimer's and dementia care, and it provides local, holistic, comprehensive, a comprehensive system of support to Alzheimer's and dementia caregivers throughout every stage of the disease. If you have any questions during the program, please feel free to email me, Judy Steinig, at steinigj@ou.org. That's steinigj@ou.org. And I'll make sure that Adina sees your questions. Thank you so much, Adina. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a real privilege to be speaking to everybody, especially about this topic, which is definitely, I consider it an incredibly important topic and one that's not usually talked about very much. I just shared my screen, so I think we're good to go. Everybody can see? Okay, great. So this is our basic agenda for today. I'm going to go through what dementia is, normal aging versus dementia, some warning signs, a little bit of a discussion about Alzheimer's disease, and what's going on in the brain, what are the stages. I'm going to touch on other causes of dementia, the medications, and what you can do as a caregiver. So dementia is actually, it describes a syndrome that's caused by an underlying medical condition. So Alzheimer's dementia is dementia that's caused from Alzheimer's disease. And this syndrome basically affects four different areas of functioning. The most common one that people know about is memory. The short-term memory tends to be, you know, is the one that's affected, and then longer-term memories get affected later on in the disease. We don't often think about cognition, but that's another piece of it. The ability to think and plan and use logic starts to be affected negatively. Behavior. Some people will say they realized something was wrong because the person with dementia started showing a complete personality change, or they were just suddenly really agitated, and that was not their usual way of being. You also do sometimes, ironically, have some people who might have been, you know, more agitated and difficult before having the disease who end up mellowing out, which is a whole other interesting discussion. But any sort of behavior change or mood change or personality change is a part of dementia. And we also don't really think about the physical aspects of dementia, but dementia also affects one's physical functioning. So it will affect motor skills, gait, balance, being able to use your fine motor skills, things like that, will all be affected by dementia. Now, a really common question I always get is, what's the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's? Or I will have people say to me, well, she just has dementia, it's not Alzheimer's, I think shows, you know, people don't really understand what the two different terms are about. Dementia is actually an umbrella term, as you can see on this slide. It's the umbrella. On one side, we have reversible causes of dementia. And on the other side, we have irreversible causes of dementia. So the irreversible causes of dementia, as I mentioned, are Alzheimer's disease, but you also have vascular dementia. You have Lewy body dementia, frontotemporal dementia. There are also, a person can have also several different types of dementia. Overall, there are about over 120 different types of dementia. Some are really rare. These are the top five. But another thing I really want to bring to people's attention is there are causes of dementia that are reversible. So the most common one that people know about is B12 deficiencies, the vitamin B12 deficiency. Possibly some other vitamin deficiencies can cause dementia. And if it's seen that the person has a B12 deficiency, it's actually pretty easy to reverse it. You start giving B12 shots and then a person's functioning can start to be restored. Another important cause of reversible dementia, and this actually can be in both people without dementia and in people with dementia, are urinary tract infections. And in older adults, urinary tract infections are not experienced the same way that a younger person would have it. There may not be pain. And a lot of times you will see difficulties or differences in their cognitive functioning. If you ever see a sudden change in somebody, like literally it seems overnight, it's very important to go to a doctor because it very well could be a urinary tract infection. This also holds true for people with dementia. If you have somebody who has dementia and suddenly there's a really steep decline, it's possible that they have a urinary tract infection. By treating the urinary tract infection, they can actually go back to their regular level of functioning. So that's just a really important piece for people to know about. Normal aging versus dementia. We all talk or joke about the senior moments that people have. But there are normal cognitive changes that happen to us as we age and abnormal ones that come with dementia. So we'll all occasionally misplace our keys. I am definitely guilty of that. It's when you forget how to use a key, then it becomes a sign of that something more is happening than just normal aging. We all forget the right word, you know, especially when we're under stress. If somebody's having difficulty following a conversation, if they can't finish their sentences, that's already a sign showing that there's something more at play than just normal aging. We all temporarily forget the day. I think now people are forgetting the day all the time. But when a person is losing track of the date and the season, not knowing what year it is, going outside in a winter coat when it's 90 degrees outside, or you know, going out in shorts when it's 30 degrees outside, that's a sign of something more than just normal aging. So I wanted to talk about some warning signs. I think that's helpful for people. The most important thing I want to highlight is my first bullet point is that the memory loss disrupts daily life. It's not simply forgetting some sort of, you know, stupid trivia or something that's really inconsequential to daily living. You're really talking about something that impairs a person's functioning in their day-to-day normal activities. So difficulty planning or solving problems. If you give a shopping list with five items, can that person go shopping? I know of a case where, you know, a wife sent her husband out to go shopping. The husband had dementia. And she sent him with, I think, like three things. Maybe it was like, you know, milk, butter, and bread. And the husband actually ended up getting two cartons of milk and then two bouquets of flowers because he could not follow the list, and he knew that he couldn't do it and he felt bad about it. So that's already, you know, something that really shows a sign of dementia. Forgetting how to do familiar tasks. I had a case of somebody who was going to work to walk. She always walked to work. It was her place of work for the last 25 years. She got lost going to the same place that she's been going to for the past 25 years. That's also a big warning sign of dementia. As I mentioned, confusion with dates, time, or place. Withdrawal from work or social situations. This is a little tricky because it can also be a sign of depression. And a lot of times, especially in the beginning stages, it can be tricky to know if some, is it is it that you have somebody who's dealing with depression, or are they dealing with dementia, or are they dealing with both? Because that can be an issue as well. So I'm going to talk more about that a little bit later. But basically, social withdrawal, difficulty initiating activities, not wanting to get out of bed, not wanting to get up and do anything really can be a sign of dementia. Misplacing objects and not being able to retrace your steps. A lot of times what happens with people who have dementia, they'll misplace an object, they won't be able to retrace their steps, and all what they will do, and this is what brains tend to do, especially in when they are dealing with any sort of impairment, is they do something called they confabulate. So I knew that my purse was on the chair, and now it's not, and my aide just came in, so it's not there anymore, so my aide must have taken it, instead of I may have put it in another room or something along those lines. Trouble with spatial relationships. This is also another thing we people don't really think about when they think about dementia, but it actually does affect visual spatial skills. If for some people with dementia, if they see a dark mat, they will think it's a hole. There are some assisted living facilities that will put a dark mat in front of the elevators to try to prevent people from leaving and from going out, because they will perceive it as a big hole. New problems with words and speaking and writing. So I kind of mentioned that difficulty finishing a sentence, not remembering the right word for objects. I know there was a famous movie, it's called Still Alice. It's about a woman who had early onset dementia, and she was holding a highlighter, and she called it like the yellow stick writing thing instead of a highlighter. That sort of thing is a sign of dementia. Mood swings and changes in personality, as I mentioned. Altered decision-making, poor judgment. I'll start with poor judgment. People at this stage are really at risk for being scammed. And you know, all of those telephone calls that we might ignore or not pay attention to, they might be lonely also. But once they talk to somebody, and if they will be told that, well, if you wire me $200, you'll win $5,000 in a trip to the Bahamas, for somebody who has this degree of impairment, that will make sense in the early stages of dementia. And a lot of people do end up with being taken in by scams. So that's just another very important piece to realize. But a lot of times also you'll see people relying on someone else, like their spouse, to either make decisions for them, sometimes even just to answer questions for them. You'll see a lot of times in older couples, if a spouse dies, suddenly the children will still call me with you know, concerns, because, you know, oh my gosh, we didn't realize how bad things were with mom, because, you know, dad was covering for her. And she was relying on him, and he sort of compensated for everything that she couldn't do. And so that's a very common experience, that, you know, they sort of defer to the well spouse to make their decisions, or to really do almost everything so that they can save face. Okay. So once you have a family member who you're concerned about, We highly suggest that you go and get a full diagnosis. There are a lot of, every major hospital in the city basically has a memory clinic. And these are specialized clinics, and they do a really thorough diagnostic process. So what they're going to do though is what's called a differential diagnosis. So with a differential diagnosis, they're basically ruling out those 120 different types of dementia and any other possible cause of anything that can cause dementia before they will give a final diagnosis of any sort of dementia, you know, also, or any sort of irreversible dementia, I should say. So what they're going to do is they're going to take a full family history. You know, does anybody else in the family have it? They're going to take a physical exam and blood test, like I mentioned, that, you know, certain vitamin deficiencies, certain other physical causes of dementia are going to be examined. They're going to have the person undergo a neuropsychological testing, where they're going to test memory, cognition, and personality. For part of this testing will be a word retrieval test, where they will give a person five words to remember. They will distract them for 5 minutes and then ask them to recall the words. They will also do something called a clock test. And what they will have is they will ask the person to draw a clock with the circle and with all the numbers and put the clock at 3:30. And this is testing a whole bunch of things. As I mentioned, the visual spatial tasks that need to be done with the clock, but it's also testing their symbolic reasoning, because 3:30 on an analog clock doesn't look like 3:30. You have the small hand on the three and the big hand on the six. So there's a certain degree of reasoning there that a person with dementia might not be able to do. So they want to see if that is the case with the person. They're also going to be doing brain imaging. A lot of people will either go for PET scans or MRI scans to see what's going on in the brain. This whole process has about a 90 to 95% accuracy, which is a very high degree of accuracy. 100% accuracy will only be, right now, it can only be accomplished upon autopsy. So that is not anything that anybody is advocating for, certainly while a person's alive, here or dead. But that's just something to know. And I will talk further about what exactly they're looking for in the brain. But I also want to talk about why diagnosis is important, because I will hear from people and they'll be saying, well, there's no cure and there's really nothing that we can do, so it's better not to know. Now, there are certain benefits to getting a diagnosis. Firstly, as I mentioned, there are reversible types of dementia. So if that's the case, you want to make sure that it's ruled out. If it's as simple as, okay, so you have to give vitamin B12 shots to somebody, I mean, I would say go do it, run. So that's important. It will also help identify additional medical conditions that can exacerbate dementia symptoms. Dementia doesn't work in a vacuum, and I will talk a little bit more about like vascular issues which can complicate dementia. At this point, anything that any expert will tell you about mitigating risk for dementia or even modifying dementia that you have is what's good for the heart is what's good for the brain. So any cardiovascular issue you want to be addressed, you want to know where everything stands. Diabetes is another complicating factor. So you want to make sure that a person's diabetes is well controlled. If a person doesn't know that they have it, they will know from this diagnostic process. So that's also important. And a diagnosis can help with that. It will be helpful in determining whether a patient is a candidate for medication that can moderate symptoms. I'll talk about that a bit more further as well, but the medications are kind of 50-50 in terms of their effectiveness. And I think a good neurologist will need to know a little bit more about the person and their functioning in order to figure out if it's worth, using. But this is really for everybody. It allows for planning. As difficult as it is to know that somebody in your family has it, especially in the earlier stages, a person can still communicate their wishes. They can still process what's going on for them. So that's really important. Powers of attorney are really important. Healthcare proxies are really important. I would argue a halachic living will is really important. Everybody over 21 should have this. Most of us don't. And this will really enable these important documents to be put out going forward for this person, which will only help the family and help them advocate. I've been working in this field for a pretty long time, over 10 years, and really without the legal documents to advocate for a family member, things can become much more complicated, difficult, and you have a lot more crises. And just by virtue of having a power of attorney, healthcare proxy, all of those things, any sort of Medicaid planning that might need to be done for help for getting home care, it can really be helpful in the long run, in the sense that you are not reacting to a crisis, but you can be more proactive with whatever comes your way. So that's another thing that diagnosis can really help with, in terms of knowing having some sort of idea of what to expect. So I'm gonna share some statistics, and they are quite sobering, but I do think it really highlights how important this issue is, particularly, in this country, these are stats for this country. Basically 5.8 million Americans live with Alzheimer's disease right now. One in three seniors die of Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is considered the sixth leading cause of death. This actually might be a conservative estimate because oftentimes when they're filling out death certificates, they'll put the direct cause of death instead of the what really contributed to it. So if you have somebody who died of pneumonia, they're going to put down pneumonia. They're not going to put down it's aspirative pneumonia because of late stage Alzheimer's. So it actually might be a higher issue. And it's, as I'm going to point out, this is affecting a lot of different people because by 2050, if nothing changes, approximately 14 million Americans are going to have Alzheimer's disease. And just in New York alone, one in five people would be affected. They're either going to have it or they're going to be caring for somebody with it. And I think, as certainly as we're seeing now with the coronavirus, the effects are really profound in terms of both the person who has it, but also on their family members. You're talking about people who are responsible for caring. There's always been issues around workplace difficulties for caregivers and whether or not a person should quit their job or shouldn't they, or how they can get flexible time. So these are all are really serious things. Another thing to consider is that a lot of people who are taking care of people with Alzheimer's are children, largely daughters, but that's kind of, I've seen plenty of sons too, who are basically in their 40s and 50s. So they're also caring for, you know, children, their own children. So there's a really, it's really a lot of stress and strain on a family. So these are really important issues, and it affects a really large amount of people. So I'm going to go a little bit more into Alzheimer's disease. I'm going to hyper focus a bit on Alzheimer's disease because it is the number one cause of dementia, and most people who have dementia have Alzheimer's. I'm going to touch on the other types because they certainly are gaining traction in terms of how many people are being diagnosed with it. But I think Alzheimer's disease also is a pretty good reflection of what to expect with dementia. So this little cell is a nerve cell, and in Alzheimer's, you have those little pink things which are called amyloid plaques, and they're basically clusters of a protein called beta amyloid, and they're actually found in everybody's brains in some fashion. In a person with Alzheimer's, they clump together in there, and they're still kind of trying to figure out why. But what basically happens is because the plaques clump together, they prevent the nerve from doing what it's supposed to do. The nerve cell, if you see those little finger-like things, they're supposed to be sending messages to the next nerve cell, and they block it. And because they block it, the nerve can no longer do what it's supposed to be doing. Its function is basically gone. So it starts to die. On top of that, you have tangles, which are basically these strands of this protein called tau, which is basically holds up the inner structure of the neuron. And that collapses, which also leads to the cell dying. So it really dies from the outside and the inside. There's a lot of, most of the research that has been going on has been around the beta amyloid. All the medications are there to try to affect beta amyloid. Has not been found particularly successful. I think now they're trying to look at tau, look at other things. There are a couple of different hypotheses about what can be going on with Alzheimer's, but it's still pretty mysterious to researchers. And as I said, the only conclusive thing they can come up with is what's good for the heart is good for the brain. And they're still trying to figure out all of the relationships between why that is. So some risk factors, age is the biggest risk factor. I think it's either 1 in 9 or 1 in 10 people over the age of 65 get Alzheimer's disease. It hits to, I think, 1 in 3 in people who are over 85. Race is a risk factor. It is actually more predominant in African American and Latino communities than in Caucasian communities. Gender, it happens more in women than in men. Down syndrome is a big risk factor, and I know there also are some studies going on about why that is, but people with Down syndrome often get it. They often get it younger. And there might be some sort of genetic link with that. And family history and genetics is another piece that contributes to risk. The more, you know, if you see more family members who have it, there is a greater risk. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get it, but it is certainly increases the risk of it. There are some genetic variants of Alzheimer's disease. Those tend to be in people who have a younger onset. If you have a family cluster where a lot of people have gotten it at very young ages, it's worth looking at genetic counseling around that, because it can be a sign of a particularly genetic form of Alzheimer's disease. Head injury is also a big risk. In fact, I when I first started giving these talks, the person who was training me would mention that she had 3-year-old twins and she will never, ever, ever let them play contact sports. It's a little draconian, but head injury does increase risk. We see this with sports figures. They end up also with different forms of dementia due to the injuries. As I mentioned, the heart-brain connection. So diabetes increases it. Any sort of cardiovascular issue will increase the risk. So these are, I guess the semi good news on that is that these are things that can be modified. These are things that there are medications to help control. There are lifestyle choices that people can make to try to mitigate some of that. Substance abuse can also be a risk factor, and hearing loss actually. If you have untreated hearing loss, it can also contribute to dementia. It can certainly contribute to that confusion and disorientation. And it is important, especially in older adults, to have their hearing checked and to wear their hearing aids and to do what they can to help their hearing as much as they can. So here are the stages of Alzheimer's. I'm going to go through them more at length after this slide, but mild cognitive impairment, which is kind of the preclinical Alzheimer's. We have the early stage, which is basically lasts from between 1 to 5 years, middle stage, which lasts between 2 and 10 years, and the late stage, which lasts between 1 to 7 years. And I mean, honestly, without other impairments, a person can easily live for 15 to 20 years with the disease. So when we talk about mild cognitive impairment, we're talking about problems with memory and thinking that other people can notice. You know, it might be that, you know, you mentioned you met somebody new, and then 5 minutes later they're starting to, you know, they talk to them as if they never met them. You know, it could be not remembering a conversation that you had 5 minutes ago. But it's not severe enough to interfere with independence. So as I mentioned before, when we're talking about Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, we're talking about something that's going to interfere with your daily functioning, with your ability to pay your bills, with your ability to prepare your food and do the things that you need to do, to basically live day to day. That being said, most people with mild cognitive impairment will go on to develop Alzheimer's disease. There is a small amount of people who actually will not, and they'll sort of just stay in this mild cognitive impairment zone. I know current researchers are basically trying to look at, well, how can we make Alzheimer's, you know, sort of push off the age that a person can get it, and then all they have to worry about is mild cognitive impairment. We still have a ways to go to even get there, but people are curious about those. Like, you know, between 20 and 40% who don't go on to get full on Alzheimer's disease. I also do want to mention though, that I have found that a lot of times doctors have a really difficult time, especially if you're not going to a memory clinic, if you're going to a regular, either a general neurologist or primary care physician, they're not going to be, and not all of them, I shouldn't say, but I've seen some doctors who have difficulty giving over this bad news. So they might tell somebody who is actually in the early stage of Alzheimer's disease that they have mild cognitive impairment. And so I have seen that as well. So I would say to be careful when you see a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment, to really keep in mind, is this person able to function on their own or not? Because I think that's really what the question becomes. So what if somebody's that goes back, let's say going on to the earlier, to the early stage, you'll see more short-term memory loss, mild confusion to an orientation to place and time, not realizing, you know, where they are, what they are. They may wake up at 12 o'clock in the morning and think that it's time to get ready to go to work, and act that way. One thing I have seen as well, in working with the firm community, is a lot of times you'll have people who will think that it's Shabbos all the time, which can also be very difficult for caregivers because, and truthfully, and the person with dementia, because it'll be like, why am I living with all these Mechalei Shabbos? But that is also a something that is certainly unique to our community. Progressive inability to follow complex instructions. You really can't tell somebody with any sort of dementia to do more than one thing at a time. I had a client who was talking about her mother she was always a great cook, and she was in the kitchen. I think it was Thanksgiving. It was some sort of holiday, and she's chopping vegetables on the cutting board. And usually like the family congregates and they talk, and she couldn't talk and cut the vegetables at the same time anymore. It had to be one thing. That's another issue with dementia. Problems with money is a huge issue at this point. A lot of times people will forget to pay their bills. They might forget that they paid their bills, and they might pay their bills several different times. As I mentioned, scams. And more often than not, I think the problems with money is really when people will start calling for help. Like family members will start calling and asking for help, because it really is when families cannot deny anything anymore. So as I mentioned, the beginning to lose initiative and motivation, you know, it'll be harder for them to get up in the morning and to do things, to go to their keep up with their regular routines and do the things that they want to do. Progressive difficulty performing regular tasks. It might be difficult getting dressed. They may not want to get dressed into something different than what they're already wearing. Showering might be something they don't really want to do anymore. And it might be a fight to get them to shower. They'll have progressive difficulty learning new things, routines, people, et cetera. And as we see in our age of technology, that can be a big problem. And we see increasingly poor judgment, which kind of falls into everything I've just described, where their ability to make logical decisions is affected. Now, even with all of these things that are negatively impacting a person, we want to still consider that there are things that they can still do. They can still understand the implications of their illness. So as I mentioned, this is the time to really start working on you know, advanced directives, healthcare proxies, power of attorneys, halachic rules, and all of that. You know, thinking about, you know, looking at talking to an attorney if you know, in terms of Medicaid planning and things like that. That this is really the time to do it. They can still participate in decision making. I mean, you know, this is a common issue with a lot of different illnesses in older people, especially, but you know, doctors will tend to talk to the caregivers and not to the person directly. They can still be spoken to. They can still be interacted with. And they can also still identify and articulate their feelings. And they can still often live independently. They might need a little assistance here and there, but they can still be pretty independent. And our concerns really for them as people who care about them is for their autonomy, their self-esteem, and their dignity. You know, a person at this stage knows how much, you know, probably knows more than we do how much they're losing in terms of their abilities. And that can really negatively impact their self-esteem and the way they feel about themselves, especially if they're a high-performing person. We want to try to help them to feel as effective as they possibly can feel, and as needed as they can feel. And so that's something to think about as family members. So middle stage symptoms. So here you will see even more memory loss and confusion, difficulty thinking logically and organizing thoughts. You'll see more difficulty with keeping up with a conversation. They might be able to engage. They probably will be able to engage in pleasantry and very light conversation. But if there's any sort of real deep discussion of any sort, they really cannot participate in that anymore. There might be problems with recognition. They might not be able to recognize you as a son or daughter, even spouse. They might think that you're, you know, mother, aunt, cousin, whatever. You'll see mood swings and changes. Here's really where sundowning happens. Sundowning is where a person with dementia becomes agitated towards the late afternoon. So, you know, they might get really paranoid, or they might not be able to sit still. There may be a lot of difficulties in just keeping them calm and happy at this point. Hallucinations and delusions are also something that's common. It also is common that it happens with sundowning. Motor problems, this is where people will start having difficulty with balance and with walking. Incontinence can become a problem, either because they forget to go to the bathroom, or when they're in the bathroom, they forget all of the processes that come with cleaning oneself. Wandering becomes an issue, and increased difficulty with dressing and personal care. You know, a person might see a shirt and they'll start putting it on his pants. It can be at that point. However, again, we do want to consider that there are things that they still can do. There are modified activities. They can still participate in modified activities. And this is really where I think social adult day programs come in. Those are really wonderful. And what they are, they're usually, you know, they're small programs. They engage in a lot of art or music or things that are more sensory based and not so cognitive. And what they are, they provide what's called a no-fail environment. It's all about process. It's not about content. It's all about just doing and being. One really cute activity that they do in these in Alzheimer's programs. It's called time slips. And you'll have a group and they'll sit in a circle, and each person will say a sentence, anything that comes to mind. And at the end of everybody going around, the leader of the group will read what was said, and everybody usually has a really good laugh about it because it's just really funny. And it's just really about just sitting and enjoying with each other and just interacting. So they can do that. They enjoy that. It makes them feel good. And that's really the type of experiences you want to enable them to be in as much as possible at this stage. They can still make choices, but you want to enable it to be a modified choice. We don't think, when I'm just taking for one example, with the putting on clothing or getting dressed, we don't think about how many processes it takes in our mind to get dressed in the morning, but it really means you go to your closet, you have to find a top, a bottom, it has to be weather appropriate, it has to match. It has to, like, there are all of these considerations that we're making that we don't even realize that a person with Alzheimer's or any other dementia really will not be able to do. But they also don't want you to make choices in terms of how they're getting dressed. I mean, I don't know too many people who do want that. So it might be helpful to lay out maybe, you know, a set of clothing or a dress or whatever. And would you like to wear the blue dress or the red dress? And this way they can make a choice, but it doesn't have to be that they're making all of the decisions because their brain can't handle that anymore. And they can still also make social and emotional connections. Many people still, they like being around people, and they can still appreciate, I mean, frankly, I'll even say in the later stages, there still may be an appreciation of a person and of touch and of human contact. You may not be able to perceive it. Here you can still perceive it. And the concerns really at this point for a person and for stuff that a caregiver should really keep in mind is the loss of control, because here at this point they really can't live alone anymore. It's usually not safe. And as we mentioned, that even just choice becomes a whole cheshbon in terms of, you know, well, how much choice can you give somebody, because they can't make all of the choices that they used to. So that can become really frustrating for them. It's also really frustrating for them because they don't have the same degree of communication that they used to. So they're not going to be able to talk about how they're feeling, but they'll be able to show you with their anger. So it's really important to also keep in mind that when we see behavior is communication. And as caregivers, what we have to really try to figure out is what is the person trying to communicate to me when they're acting this way? And it can take some trial and error, but it can be quite effective. And it certainly can help, as opposed to say just medicating the person, that's a bit of a complicated discussion, but it is important to keep in mind to think about how the environment can be modified for the person who you're taking care of. So then in the later stage, we have limited verbal communication. They're really not able to speak very much. Minimal recognition of family or self. They're more sedentary and eventually bedbound. They have eating difficulties. At this point, they really need full 24/7 care. And more often than not, it really requires nursing home care in order to be safe. But at the same time, as I mentioned, there are abilities. The person still has awareness of their surroundings. They still benefit from sensory stimulation. Even if they can't respond, they benefit. Music, a person can be really responsive to music. I have found that people who have dementia, if they're put in a music-rich environment, if their favorite songs are always on, there is a benefit to that. They usually are calmer. Touch, anything that's not verbal or not cognitive, you don't have to necessarily think about it, but you can experience it. They can be really beneficial. And at this point, the concerns really are about the person's comfort and dignity. You also want to keep in mind, though, as I mentioned, with the nursing home care, there is a greater risk at this point for medical issues. Contractures, where the muscles kind of contract, that usually happens. Skin breaks down. This is where people tend to get wounds. That's also why I say that with a nursing home, you kind of have to be on top of the nursing home, but it can be much safer than at home, where you need somebody to turn the person every 2 hours. And if there's only a spouse, that doesn't usually happen, or it doesn't happen safely. But those are other things to consider. So I'm going to mention some other common types of irreversible dementia. So Lewy body dementia is actually, I'm finding more people are getting diagnosed with that. And what Lewy body dementia is, are memory and thinking problems that are similar to Alzheimer's disease. But the initial presentation is with dementia, but also with Parkinson's symptoms. So with Parkinson's, a person can get dementia at the later stages of Parkinson's. But this is where it's not Parkinson's that gradually gets the dementia, it's Parkinson's and dementia at the same time. And so you'll see sleep disturbances, visual hallucinations, tremors, rigidity with the memory and thinking problems that you'll find with Alzheimer's disease. Vascular dementia is also pretty common. It's where you have TIAs, microscopic bleeding or blood vessel blockages, which blocks blood and oxygen to the brain cells. And the location of injury determines how the functions change, like what a person can and cannot do, or how it affects their thinking. But more often than not, you will see a person who has impaired judgment or inability to plan. Frontotemporal dementia is also, I'm finding more people are being diagnosed with that. It usually happens earlier. You'll see more personality changes and difficulties with language over memory loss, although memory loss does eventually happen. And life expectancy is shorter with frontotemporal. Mixed dementias, so as I mentioned, with all of the dementias, you can often have many at the same time. I remember I read once that even with Alzheimer's disease, there could be, more often than not, if a person has Alzheimer's disease, there is a vascular component and it can be mixed, or is often mixed with vascular dementia. So that is also not uncommon. So as I mentioned with the medications, they are all trying to take out all that beta amyloid, which may or may not be helpful. I find that with medications, clients of mine will either swear by it or say it was awful, an awful experience and not worth it. Or they don't really know, but they're afraid to take it away because who knows what'll happen if you don't use it. As I mentioned, it's only about a 50% success rate, which is not great. They also do come with significant side effects. So I always tell people it's always important to talk to your doctor, who you trust about whether or not they feel that it's something that's beneficial for the person you're caring for or not, because there is usually cost-benefit analysis to taking these medications. So what you can do. So slow down and allow more time for activity. For people with Alzheimer's and other dementias, it can be really, just getting ready in the morning can take forever. People always, I have caregivers who are always complaining that they have to be somewhere and it took, they ended up being late an hour because it took the person they're caring for way too long to get ready. So one way of handling that is you tell them that they have to be ready an hour earlier and then you'll get that hour. So even just trying to slow down, adjusting expectations. I think honestly, the biggest difficulty that I think caregivers often have, or at least the first hurdle, is usually coming to an acceptance of the disease and of the challenges that it presents with. Once you can kind of open to that and you know, see it, then you can kind of figure out a plan of how to navigate it and deal with it. So keeping things simple, again, you don't want to give multi-step directions of any sort. Avoiding distractions. So if you need to talk to somebody, make sure the TV is off. Make sure that it's in a quiet room. Make sure that it's not something that you're not in a place where there's going to be too much going on. It can definitely be too stimulating for them, and they're not going to be able to focus. Don't argue, reassure, and redirect. This can be really hard, especially when there might be some paranoia involved and they're accusing you or other people of stealing. What you really want to do is either, redirect their attention to something else. Try to connect with their feelings of loss, of losing whatever it was that they lost, and have them talk about that, and eventually they can walk out of it. But I think ultimately what I would like you to get from this point is that you can't argue with dementia. Dementia always wins. So it's really about getting around the dementia, or how can you do this little dance to get the person to where they should be. So as I mentioned, behavior is communication. There is no cure, but there is good care. And good care is really important with this disease. The other thing that's really important as caregivers is taking care of yourself. I'm sure that you've heard this before, but, on an airplane flight, when they do the safety discussion, they're always telling you have to put on your oxygen tank before you put on your child or anybody else you're taking care of. And it's really true. If you're not going to care for yourself, you're not really going to be able to help the other person, and which will put that person even more at risk. And getting help is really important. One person cannot do this. It really takes a coordinated effort and support from other people as well. So that's where we come in Caring Kind. There are other organizations in the city as well. It's really important to get support for yourself. So here are some things to remember also as caregivers, and actually I think this is the most important thing, is that your feelings are normal. It is very normal to feel angry. It is very normal to feel guilty. I think those are probably the top two that I always hear. Almost anything that a person feels is normal. And they can be positive. They can be negative, but they can also be positive. I've had people who have found positive experiences or felt positive about what they're doing. So I think it's important to really be able to be compassionate to yourself and allow yourself to feel everything that you want. And again, with professionals, we can certainly take all of the feelings that come our way. You cannot do this alone. Again, really important to get support. Also, keep in mind to do the best you can. There's no such thing as perfect. I know with parenting, they talk about there's no such thing as the perfect parent. There's the good enough parent. I would say the exact same thing with caregiving. There's no such thing as the perfect caregiver. In fact, it's impossible because you're talking about a disease with so many losses that just keep coming. But there is the possibility of being the good enough caregiver. And I think that's something to aspire to, and to be. And also just realize we are here to help you. So here is my information if anybody wants to take it down. We have a helpline. You can certainly reach me at the helpline. You can ask to speak to me. You can speak to our other social workers who are on staff. We provide one-on-one support for care planning. We do emotional support. We have support groups. We do other we have other education seminars and training. We actually have a 5-week, I mean, God willing, when this is over, it will actually be happening. But we have a 5-week family caregiver workshop where you can actually go. It's a half day training, and they'll go through difficult behaviors and techniques of how to, you know, navigate things, you know, more at length than what I've just discussed. We also have a wanderer safety program. As I mentioned, with wandering, 2/3 of all people with dementia will wander. We have a bracelet program with Medic Alert, which has a tracking number on it. And if a person is found, they can, with that bracelet, it's found that they will be reunited with their family much quicker than if they don't do anything. We have Connect to Culture with cultural institutions in New York City to provide programming for people with dementia. We have a day program for people with mid-stage dementia at our office in Manhattan. And we have various events throughout the year, throughout the month. So you're more than welcome to contact our helpline for more information about that. So thank you. And I'm wondering if there are any questions.
Well, if there are any questions and anyone wants to email me, I will get them to Adina as soon as we can. That might be following the program, but Adina,
I can call or email also.
I want to thank Adina. Thank you so much. It was just, there was just such a wealth of information and strategies and just so much that we can all take away from this. We really, really appreciate it. By the way, a number of people came in probably late because they just got the email for the OU Today one. Not to worry, our plan is always to record. We record every session, and as long as Zoom cooperates and actually does do the recording, our goal always is to get out the recording to you. And most of you should have been realizing I've been sending the recordings out following the program. We're going to also put Adina's information with that. It might not be until tomorrow, but everybody who has registered, and you can't be watching this unless you registered, everybody who has registered will receive the recording, and then you'll be able to have that whenever you need. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. I just want to also mention that some people are hearing about this, and we really appreciate it, through synagogues that have been partnering with us to promote this program. When you get the email from us, we list all the partnering synagogues. If yours is not on it and you heard about it in some other way, please mention to your rabbi or president. There is no charge to become a partner synagogue. We'll send them an email. And the idea is we want as many people as possible to know about these programs. And we need to do it through many different ways. So if your synagogue is not on the list, you can ask about it and have them contact us. We're also going to be sending out an email to rabbis so that they should know about it. And you mention it to them. Mention that you've been on the program and you think it's worthwhile, because we just want to get the message out to more places. I just want to mention that next week we will be back on Tuesday. That is, I think, May 19th, I think, at 11 o'clock. And we'll be doing Overcoming Procrastination, Change One Habit with Debbie Ginsburg. I think it's something that everybody, I certainly can relate to it, and I'm sure everybody can too. Now, I just want to mention, we're not sure yet the platform, whether it'll be Zoom or watch your emails. If it's not through Zoom for varying technical reasons, you'll get an email telling you where to access the program. So, and we'll also do it on Zoom. So just stay tuned. I want to wish everybody a good Shabbos. Again, thank you, Adina, so much. It was just superb.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, everybody.